ॐ भद्रं कर्णैः सुनयामदेवाः भद्रं पश्येमाक्षभिर्यजत्राः स्थिरैरङ्गैस्तुष्टुवागुंसस्तनूभिः व्यसेम देवहिदं यदायुः स्वस्ति न इन्द्रो वृद्धश्रवाः स्वस्ति न पूषा विश्ववेदाः स्वस्ति नस्तार्क्ष्यो अरिष्टनेमि स्वस्ति नो बृहस्पतिर्दधातु ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः. So we are continuing discussion. So yesterday, one very important point that I tried to emphasize was this idea that liberation or self-realization is not a new development. It is not the acquisition of a new information or knowledge. Rather, it is a discovery of something about our own true nature. It's just like coming back, returning to our own home. When you return to your own home, you are not actually getting a new home. It is the place where you left or you forgot about and you returned. So this is a very, very important idea in Vedanta. It's an interesting aspect to remember. That's why there is a verse in the Taittiriya Upanishad. The Taittiriya Upanishad also is there, you know, in the Ananda Valley, where the bliss is explained in different editions. The highest bliss is the bliss that we experience when we realize our true nature. And also you find in the Bhrigu Valley, the last realization that little boy Bhrigu realized was Ananda eva imani bhudani jayante anandena jatane jivanti anandam prayanti abhisambhisanti. Now, I mentioned earlier, this ananda or this inner blissfulness is experienced in deep sleep and also in samadhi. This is an important point in Vedanta. We realize, we experience this inner blissfulness whenever we do not recognize anything other than ourselves. When you do not recognize or comprehend any object, or rather when you see the object, so-called objects, as non-different from yourself, the subject, then you experience this blissfulness. In susupti or deep sleep, we experience this without awareness. In samadhi, we experience this with awareness. But that makes a lot of difference. That's an important point to remember. So, one analogy which is really not very accurate, but that's as far as analogies can go. You know? Analogies and illustrations, parables, cannot go beyond a limit. They cannot be exactly equal to what it seeks to explain. So that's a fundamental principle. In Sanskrit, drishtanta darshtantika means what is sought to be explained with the help of an analogy and analogy itself. There is always some degree of difference. Now, the example we can say is, we may know certain things, but if we are not aware of the fact that we know it, then our knowing really is as good as ignorance. It's like that. So, in deep sleep, we experience this inner tranquility and peace, but without awareness. In samadhi, we experience it. When we experience it with awareness, then it creates a difference. It makes us a different person. It will have a transformative effect in our personality and character. So, the 15th verse of Agama Prakarana, the first chapter of the Kariga, makes a very strong point. Anyatha grinnatha svapno nidras tattvam ajanataka viparyase tayokshini turiyam padam asnude. This is a famous Karika. What it means is this. if you ever happen to read this verse, you should remember the word sopna is used. So that's a technical point, remember. Sopna literally means dream. But in this verse, dream means waking state also. So that is the magic of the commentary. So if you don't interpret this word, which in English means dream, as implying waking state also, then there will be a complete mismatch in the interpretation. So Shankaracharya enters the scene and says, this sopna or dream implies waking state also. So that's it. There is a reason for it. It is not just an arbitrary polemical interpretation. So what is the idea behind in waking state and in dream state? There are two things. One, non-recognition of the fact. And so in other words, non-perception of the fact. And wrong perception also. You not only see the rope, but also you see the snake. If you see the snake, you won't be seeing the rope. If you are able to recognize the rope as the rope, then there's no problem. You won't mistake it for a snake. So if you are looking and if you see the world alone, it means you are not seeing Brahman. And if you are looking, if you are realizing Brahman, if you are looking, if you are experiencing Brahman, then you won't be seeing the world. That's why you can read in the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna, of course, Sharadanandaji's great master. Sri Ramakrishna makes an interesting statement, you know. At the highest experience level, there is no Vedas, no Omkara, no Pranava, nothing. Silence. Then you travel, you take several steps below, and then you reach Omkara. Omkara is a symbol of Brahman, or the totality of existence. So even a word symbol, the most abstract, the most subtle word symbol cannot really define or refer to or indicate the absolute experience, because the absolute experience is of the nature of experience. You know, experience cannot be explained. Experience can only be experienced. Again, coming back to Sri Ramakrishna, he says, you know, a glass of water or tea or Starbucks coffee, you cannot write a volume and make another person understand what exactly coffee tastes like. You, the one best way to do is to give a cup of coffee. Then you write any book or anything. So no lecture, no volume can be equivalent to experience. So like that, at the highest experience level, there is no word, no book, nothing. You come several steps below and then you get the most abstract word symbol. And still several steps below, you find some important mantras, longer word symbols, Gayatri, then Vedas and so on. So the whole point is, at the highest experience level, when you experience with awareness, then it's like, as I mentioned, you know, it's just like we have got a glimpse of a vast, mighty kingdom which is ours. And if you feel you are actually a great king, and then if you're playing the role of a beggar in a Hollywood movie, you may get a Oscar award for playing the role of a beggar, because you may look more beggarly, more wretched than a professional beggar. A professional beggar may be some joy or something, but you can't express that joy when you are when you are playing the Hollywood movie. So you have to be absolutely miserable, beggar-like, and you make it an Oscar award. Similarly, if a person gets a glimpse of the highest spiritual nature of his true nature, his Atman, then he may live in this world. He may have many problems, but it won't have a devastating effect on his character. See, Ramakrishna had cancer. True. And he, of course, he underwent treatment. Vivekananda had diabetes. So all great spiritual teachers, many of them had. Jesus Christ was crucified. Many often we think this question, Jesus Christ, if he was a big man, then why was he crucified? He could have driven away all the Roman soldiers. He could have applied a miracle. People ask very, very silly questions. They think that saving the body is a big deal for Jesus Christ. People think Sri Ramakrishna was so divine, he could have cured the cancer. But they won't consider this body as worth taking much care of. So they won't, they won't think it's very important to get remedy for these things. Because this body is something made of five elements, which is certainly not of very, very important, not an eternal entity. So they won't give much importance to it. So people, great prophets, great spiritual seekers, after realizing the highest spiritual enlightenment, reaching the enlightenment, may leave the world, and for all practical purposes, appearances, they may be living like any other normal human being. Rather, the miracle makers, they do not belong to the highest category in Vedantic tradition. If somebody demands, you may use a miraculous power to teach a great truth, as if you may use, people, great spiritual teachers may use their extraordinary skills, astrasiddhi is called, eight great skills, for teaching a great truth to humanity, or to achieve some wonderful things for the good of others, but they won't go about exhibiting it. So, because it's not an important thing, if they exhibit it itself is a disqualification from the Vedantic perspective. Sri Ramakrishna uses some very strong and complimentary expressions with regard to these called miraculous powers, which he looked down upon. So the point is, the greatest spiritual person may feel and may experience his true nature, but then he may live a normal life. The point is, he won't be affected by that. The Oscar award winner, after playing the role of a beggar, will go in the evening, remove his makeup and stay in a 5-star hotel. So he may feel miserable when he's playing the role in front of the camera. And we may think the fellow is so terrible, we may feel like giving him $1. Because he feels so, he's so beggarly looking. But after that, he himself won't be affected. Why? Because after the makeup is removed, he'll go and stay in the 5-star hotel, super luxury hotel. So he's not affected. A liberated person, a spiritually enlightened person is like that. He may live in this world, he may have all the ordinary things, but they won't have a devastating effect on his, or impact on his personality or life. He can look upon them as just a sport, as a play. You don't get serious when you are playing. If you get serious, then something wrong with you. Not only that, you won't be able to enjoy a play if you are... See, in a World Cup, they have to be very serious. But at the same time, after the many great footballers or cricket players, may play, cricket players play football for hobby. And that is sport for them. But working out for cricket match is not a hobby. It is a serious thing. So professional footballer, for him, football workout is a serious business. But after that, for relaxation, he may play some other sport, which is a hobby for him. So you are not very serious. You take things in a very light way when you actually look upon something as a play. So the great spiritual personalities who have realized this highest spiritual experience with awareness, samadhi, as we call the highest experience, they will be able to look upon their life and whole world as mere play. Just like an Oscar award winning Hollywood actor looks upon his role as a beggar as a playful thing, because he's not affected by that. So the point is, in Sushupti, you don't get this awareness. Susupti comes and goes. You are not aware of it. So it doesn't have any impact in our experience. Samadhi will have a transformative effect in our experience because we suddenly realize we own an empire. Swarajya Siddhi is the name of that book that Swamiji was indirectly referring to someday in some lecture recently, read recently, a few days back. So when you reach that experience with full awareness, suddenly you feel you have really got back to your home. You have realized your true identity. So you became a different person. Otherwise, deep sleep, waking state, and dream state, they all have one fundamental important common factor. The common factor is non-recognition, non-awareness of a true nature. We do not understand, we don't realize our true nature, that we are Atman. So in waking state, we look upon this empirical world and all its momentary things, and we look upon them as permanent in waking state. So because we do not see the reality, we misinterpret the reality for the unreal. Rather, we misinterpret the impermanent world as something permanent. We misinterpret these momentary experiences, money, wealth, status, problems, anxieties, all these, we misinterpret as something permanent, which actually they are impermanent. So on the one hand, there is total absence of perception, right perception, and then it is automatically followed by misperception or recognition and non-recognition of the real leads to recognition of the unreal, which is actually not there. So non-perception and misperception, something you do not recognize. The example, the rope you do not see. Because you do not see the rope, you see in the place of the rope, you see snake, a stick, a curve, a thin stream, and so I give the example of all these things. So it's called agrahanam and anyathagrahanam. Two words are used in the Mandukya tradition. One is lack of or absence of the right cognition, right understanding. Then as a consequence of this, there is wrong understanding, wrong cognition. So both that anyathagrahana means something you misunderstand for something else. A piece of rope is lying there because of lack of enough light. You mistake the rope for the snake. That is called misperception or wrong cognition. The wrong cognition is possible only because there is no real cognition. Similarly, because we do not see the Atman, the all-pervading spiritual reality, so we see only the world. The world and Atman cannot coexist. If you see the rope, there will be no snake idea. You won't be seeing the snake. If you are seeing the snake only, it's because you don't see the rope. So that is an important point to remember. Now, Maya Matram Idam Duidam Advaidam Paramarthataka. The Mandukyakarika text is very important in Vedanta tradition for one important reason. You know, the reason is it projects the central idea, which is actually the last word of Vedanta, the last conclusion of Vedanta, that is, the world does not come into existence. That's the idea. Ajatavada, it is called. So onto a phenomenology of Gaudapada is called the doctrine of non-origination of the universe. So how is it like? You have to think of the old analogy, the dark room where there is not enough light, something lying on the floor which is dark in color, somewhat curved, you mistake that object to be either a snake because it resembles a snake that you saw and you remember, you may have seen the snake in the zoo or in the forest, or it may that piece of rope may resemble a thin stream of water, because he told Jaladhara is another example, or a crack on the floor, Bhuchidra. If there's a crack on the floor, that also could be mistaken to be altis. And also maybe a curved stick. So a piece of rope could be mistaken to be any of these things. It's possible. Now the question arises, if there is a snake, let us say, suppose you mistake the rope for the snake, and you later you go out, you go in search of a stick to remove the snake, and you open the door or you switch on the light and you suddenly realize the fact that it is not a rope. Sorry, it's not a snake, it is only a rope. Now what Gaudapada says is, if there was really a snake, it won't go away when you switch on the light. If there was a snake, it won't go away when you switch on the light. Similarly, if the world were real, then the world will not disappear when you realize your Atman, your true nature. So that is the analogy. So where was the snake idea? The snake idea was in our mind. It was created by a combination of factors. First, you can see something. It was total darkness, you won't see anything. You could see something, there was a little light, mandandhakara, Sanskrit, it means dim light. And then the object resembled things that you have seen in the past, which you remember in your mind. So you superimpose each shape on the object that you see in front of you, which is a piece of rope. So all these factors combined together can create a fantasy, this what you call wrong cognition. So yesterday one of our devotees asking, how did this ignorance arise? Ignorance first of all did not come into existence, because the snake never came into existence. Snake idea came into existence. So the ignorance idea came into existence. So what Gaudapada, who is actually focusing on the last word of Advaita, Shankaracharya will tell you at the end. He will take you all the way from kindergarten to primary school to Stanford, Harvard and then Oxford. Which I consider to be people born, they will say from Oxford you come to Harvard, that is Americans won't tolerate if you say from Harvard to Oxford. It's a joke only, don't mistake it. Now the point is, Shankaracharya takes you all the way from kindergarten to the highest university. But Gaudapada drags you to the top of the building and tells you something. So that's a statement here. He says the world has not come into existence. This is saying the snake has not come into existence. And that is prapanjoyadi vidyeda nivartyedana samshayaka. If the world had come into existence, then it won't go away. If there was a snake in the room, then you cannot disappear when you switch on the light. No, it cannot disappear. Because you didn't see the snake when you switch on the light, it only means that it was not there. It was there only in your idea, in your mind. And what was the role of the light? The light did not produce a rope. The light only removed the darkness that stood in your way of realizing that it was a rope and not a snake. That's why in Vedanta, that's a very unique greatness of Vedanta, scriptures do not have any dictatorial power. Shankaracharya says, Srutya, Yuktya, Swanubhuti, a very bold statement. He says, you read all these books, but need not believe blindly. You read, you understand, you think, use your brain, your logical powers, you analyze. And then, if you feel it's okay, it agrees with your logic, then you should try to reach the experience dimension of this philosophy. It's a very, very daring statement. It was this approach that made Vivekananda popular when he came to this country. See, I mentioned this during the discussion, you know. When Vivekananda came, established religion were facing a lot of problems. Darwin published his Original Species in 1954, perhaps. Karl Marx and Engels published Das Kapital and Communist Manifesto. You remember, they were all highly radical thought systems, not the degenerated, violent political ideologies. Marx never would have dreamt of terrible things that happened in Russia or China, for that matter. God's sake. Marx and Engels thought of, they were actually formulating highly radical, humanistic, a bit anarchical system of humanism. And they questioned the Bible, they questioned established religions, saying that these are anti-humanistic. So, Darwin's followers, the evolutionists, questioned creationism. Neo-positivists and positivists questioned religious values. And radical humanists also questioned religion as being anti-humanistic. So, in such a situation, Swami Vivekananda makes his appearance in this country. And he interprets a religion which is humanistic essentially, which is not anti-scientific, which does not and never asks you to believe blindly in anything. The greatest promise of Vedanta is you ask any question whatever you want. The greatest exponent of Vedanta in modern times was Vivekananda. And this teacher was Ramakrishna Paramahamsa. And he was a very orthodox conservative person who didn't go to university the way Vivekananda went. And the one reason why Ramakrishna Paramahamsa liked his disciple was, his disciple was not willing to accept blindly anything. So, unwillingness to accept blindly whatever he was told was a great qualification for Vivekananda in the eyes of this conservative spiritual teacher, Ramakrishna Paramahamsa. He used to say, oh, this fellow is a daring fellow. He asks questions. Wonderful. He was very happy because the Vivekananda was an agnostic. He was reading, by the way, he was reading books on humanism, books on Darwinism when he was going to Scottish College. And his own professors, many of them were humanists, members of the Church of England, the Scottish Church College was directly, most of the professors were members of the Church of England or Church of Scotland. They were well-educated humanists from Europe. And they were happy with Vivekananda, a young man who was an agnostic. And Sri Ramakrishna was more happy with him because he was asking questions. He was refusing to believe blindly whatever he was told. That was Shankaracharya, 1100 years earlier, had shouted at the top of his voice, Srutya, Yuktya, Swanubhutya. You listen to the scriptures, then use your own logical powers and reasoning, and then bring it to your own experience. Do not believe blindly whatever the scriptures, or any books for that matter, proclaim. That's so. Here you find Vedanta says this should be brought to our own experience. That means this world, which is made of the five elements, exists for some time and disappear. They are impermanent. So maya matram idam dvaidam. This empirical phenomenal world of duality is maya matram. Maya is relativity. That it belongs to time, space and causation, relative, empirical, phenomenal. That is called Maya. So Maya is not absolute non-existence. It is not absolute existence either. If the world were totally wrong or unreal, as very often, you know, translators of Vedanta texts into English have committed a terrible blunder, I would say almost a sin, by translating the word Maya into illusion. With the first great teacher who tried to correct this wrong translation was Vivekananda, who in his lecture in London tried to correct this wrong translation. In fact, Maya is not illusion. Maya is experiencing, seeing something, and then looking upon that momentary experience as permanent. That is Maya. So Maya is not total non-existence. It is not complete existence either. Because if it were completely, absolutely an existent reality, it will not change, it will not disappear. If it were completely, absolutely non-existent, we will never talk about it. We will not talk about anything which we cannot even intellectually conceive of. Such an idea will never occur. Nobody talks about anything which even intellectually we cannot even conceive of. People who do that, they're called suffering from delusions. It's a psychiatric problem, actually. When you believe in things which are obviously, absolutely unreal. So, this verse says, this Advaita, this Atman is only reality. Maya matram idam dvaitam, this empirical world and all these experiences come and go. Here in this verse, there is one important point that is made here, that is Sopna, that is dream and waking state, have got these two aspects. One is absence of right cognition and the possibility of wrong cognition. In waking state, we don't see the reality, the Atman, and we see this world, and we look upon this world as the absolute reality. So there is the absence of the right cognition and also the possibility of wrong cognition. And this is true in dream and also in waking state. But in this deep sleep, there is no wrong cognition. There is only non-cognition. There is total absence of cognition, but there is no wrong cognition, because in deep sleep we don't see anything. Tayoho taijasa prajnayoho viparidyase kshine iti yojana susupte ajnanameva vishayam idupajaryade tad bijatva tasya. So it's a commentary in Shankaracharya. Now we will come to the next important point that yesterday somebody raised, which is very important, and that is looking upon our normal life as a state of spiritual stupor, spiritual sleep. And this is a very famous argument. You find this in the lives of many saints. Augustine's confession, a real confession can bring about a total change in the life of a believer. So you don't confess every week unless you look upon it as a license renewal program. Real confession is actually the beginning of a change, real change in our life. So, and every such change, every such transformation that you find in the lives of, see, men like St. Augustine, St. Francis of Assisi, you find many. It's really awakening to a new life. And compared to that awakened state, the pre-awakening state of life is a kind of spiritual sleep. That is a simple and the most direct understanding of this particular state. But we understand, we recognize we are sleeping only when we wake up. When we are in a state of sleep, we don't interpret our state of sleep as sleep when we are in sleep. So when we use the word sleep, a state of ignorance, it is only an interpretation of that state from a state which is other than itself. After awakening, when we look back, oh, I was sleeping. So the verse is very famous for those who are interested. Agama Pragan, first chapter of the Kariga. It is the 16th verse of the first chapter of കേടുപാത കാരണം. ദ വേഴ്സ് ഇസ് സിമ്പിൾ. അനാദി മായയാ സുപ്തോ യഥാ ജീവപ്രബുദ്ധ്യത അജമനിദ്രമ സ്വപ്നം അദ്വൈതം ബുദ്ധ്യത തഥാ. At that moment, at that time, suddenly we realize the fact we are this Atman. The God whom we were searching for is actually present in us. In the ultimate analysis, we are not different from the divine reality. Not as this psychophysical mechanism or this body-mind complex, but in all of us there is the presence of that divine reality as an indweller. So that's the literal meaning. And when you with this you realize, it's like getting back to your own home. Then you realize you mistook all other places outside as alien lands, strange foreign lands, and our own home as our own home. So our real home is this spiritual identity. That's the meaning, you know, the first song that Vivekananda sang in the presence of Sri Ramakrishna. It's a Brahma Samaj famous song, you know. Mind, playing the mind to go back its own real abode, not moving abode in foreign lands. So that's the meaning of it. That's the first great song, it's a very famous song. It's a deep spiritual implication that Sri Ramakrishna wanted Swami Vivekananda to sing and he sang. It's famous. Anyway. So coming to the subject. So anadi maya sukto. So we are asleep. What is this state of sleep? It is maya. Maya, as you should remember, maya is relativity. In simplest possible language, we can say maya is nothing but the problem of looking upon the impermanent as the permanent, looking upon the relatively real as the absolutely real, looking upon things of a few years or a few decades as everlasting entities. That's what Maya is. And that's what we are all within all the time. So, yada jiva prabuddhite. So, when a jiva, a spiritual seeker, realizes his own nature, suddenly he realizes that he was asleep. Spiritually, he was in a state of stupor. And Maya expresses itself as our ordinary interpretations, our interpretations of our own life and activities. This is mine. I am dash and dash, son or daughter, husband, wife, brother, sister, grandfather, grandmother, and so on. All we limit ourselves to so many contexts, so many small little cells, and we interpret ourselves in terms of our actions. We call ourselves, we are musicians, mathematicians, we are drivers, singers, or we may interpret ourselves as brothers, sisters, or we may interpret an object as black and white, white flower, green flower, yellow flower, and so on. This is called jati, guna, dravya, karma, sambandha. Five types of interpreting things, five types of verbalization. Pancha Shabda Pravritti is called five types of verbalization. I already explained this, so no need to repeat now. So we interpret ourselves as so many things that we actually are not, because we fail to interpret ourselves to be what we actually are. So, and when we realize this, suddenly we realize our natural state is that we are Atman, we are the ever liberated. This liberation is not a new achievement, new acquisition, it is our natural state. Now, I know that this is a bit too, this tall order, not easy even to intellectually understand. So I shall try to explain this, how it actually works in spiritual life. So in the light of two illustrations. One from a classical devotional book like Bhagavata, another is from Upanishad. So first I shall try to explain this in the light of a story. The story is very simple. You know, there was a prince and he was 21 years old. He was fit to be the next heir apparent. he was fit to succeed his father. The dad, it so happened that the king, his father, and ministers, and all the courtiers, yeah, made all elaborate arrangements for his coronation. That night he died. This story. So, Prince, you have to remember the whole story. A very famous incident which throws revealing light into many of these apparently abstract spiritual concepts. So a prince who was 21 years old, who was fit to be a king, and his father had decided to make him his successor, and all preparations were ready for the coronation ceremony the next day. Unfortunately, that king dies that night. So you can imagine the state of the mental condition of the royal couple and ministers and others who all had great expectations from the prince. So many sages, many philosophers came and tried to console the father and mother, the royal father and mother. But they could not console them. So they're crying and weeping. Finally, a great philosopher, his name is Narada, who was the teacher of great teachers in mythological literature. But they say he's a historical figure, a great philosopher, saint, who appeared in that palace. And that was his mission. All the time when there was a problem, he will appear and give a helping hand, some guidance to spiritual seekers. So when he reached the palace, the king narrated the whole tragic story. And then the philosopher saint, he tried to convince him, you know, this body should come and go. Life is not permanent. Your son, if he doesn't die today, he may have to die after 50 years, 60 years. No one can escape death. So all these great, normal, common sense ideas he discussed with the king. But to no effect, he could not be consoled. Finally, this philosopher, King Narada, he had some supernatural powers. So the dead body of the prince was lying there. So by his miraculous powers, he brought back this prince to life, brought him back to life. So, and Narada called him and he got up as he was sleeping and he woke up. Then Narada told him, see, he had died the previous day, less than 24 hours. So he told him, look here, your friends, your parents, your ministers, they're all crying and weeping. They are heartbroken. Why don't you yourself console them? Then the prince asked a question. What parents? Which are the parents? Because he had left this physical body. And he was preparing to enter another physical body for the rebirth, reincarnation. Till you realize your true nature with Atman, we transmigrating from cycle to cycle, from body to body. One may live for 100 years, may die, and that Atman, that Jiva, will enter another physical body and he'll be born as the children of some other parents. So it goes on. So once this body, once this prince's body collapsed, his individual soul left that body. He lost his connection with this particular king and his mother. So he did not recognize, because there were so many, maybe tens of thousands of pairs of parents were lined up in his previous life. So he could not recognize, whom are you talking about? Which pair of parents? Suddenly the royal couple realized, well, practically there is nothing that we can do about it. Even the son himself doesn't recognize us. He is already on his way to be born again. So what's the point of worrying and weeping and crying? So they became very wise. They stopped crying and weeping. Now the point is, the highest spiritual wisdom which was preached and talked, discussed with them, didn't have any effect. Yeah. And they themselves were well-known, well-read people. Kings in those days were extremely well-educated in all the scriptures and philosophical systems. But when the sage just pointed out physically, see, the so-called son of yours doesn't even recognize you as with any special connection, any more than his connection with so many other parents, whose child he was in so many previous life cycles. So that suddenly made them understand that the so-called birth is not a beginning and the so-called death is not an end. Death is only a semicolon or a comma, and is only a prelude to another beginning of human existence. So this is one way of getting the highest wisdom. Another and much more traditional way of getting this wisdom, I mean the dynamics of spiritual awakening, so to speak. Spiritual awakening, you know, anadi maya supto. We are asleep in a state of spiritual stupor, beginningless spiritual sleep. That's what the verse means. So how do we travel from an idea to experience? How to translate this from the state of a conviction or an idea or a concept to real life experience that actually helps us in our day-to-day activities? So that is explained in one of the stories when the Chandogya Upanishad comes in the Samaveda, the 6th chapter of Chandogya Upanishad. It has got total 16 Brahmanams. Brahmana means sections. From 8th to 16th one, in 9 sections, 9 chapters. It's not chapter, rather different subsections, small divisions of the same chapter. From 9 to 16, there is an elaborate discussion of one great Vedic statement, that is, the reality, the Atman, the God whom you are looking for is actually within you. It is your own true nature. When you realize this by meditation, by prayer, by leading a pure life, as you mentioned, you find the kingdom of God is not high in the heavens, it is within you yourself. This idea you find in there. The story, there are many examples, many illustrations, total 8 illustrations, and 8 repetitions, total 9 statements of the state Tattum Asi. It is a discussion between a father, a great sage, and his son. The father's name, the name of the sage is Uddalaka, and the little boy who learns this as his son and disciple is Shvetaketu. The story is this. Once a pilgrim was returning home. He had come from Gandhara Desa. So in the Upanishad, the Vedic text, you find the word Gandhara Purusha is the name used. I mean, a gentleman, a person coming from Gandhara. Gandhara is nothing but the old name of Kandahar, which is a big city in today's Afghanistan, which is part of the ancient Aryan Vedic culture, you know, Vedic cradle, the cradle land of Upanishad Vedic culture. Of today's Afghanistan, Pakistan, northwestern India, they were all important areas in which this Vedic culture prevailed. Vedantic teachers lived and taught. So one pilgrim had come to India, and after his education, for many years he was returning home. His hometown was Kandahar, Gandhara, in today's Afghanistan. Now on the way, as he was traveling through a narrow road, surrounded by thick forest, he was ambushed by a group of robbers. So these robbers took all his possessions and dragged him into the thick forest, tied him to a tree with a rope, completely blindfolded so that he couldn't see anything. He didn't know in which direction he was taken from the main road leading to his hometown. So these robbers ambushed him, dragged him away from the main street leading to his hometown, Kandahar, that is Gandhara, and dragged him into a thick forest and tied him to a tree, completely blindfolded, and his hands and feet were all tied with ropes. He could move, he could talk, and they went away. This is the story. Now, the Upanishad tells us that we are all like robbers. We are all far away from our homeland.
You mean pilgrims, Swami?
Excuse me?
Did you mean pilgrims?
Yeah, pilgrim.
Pilgrims, not robbers.
Pilgrim.
Yeah. The pilgrim, yeah. The pilgrim, excuse me, the pilgrim is the spiritual seeker. The pilgrim corresponds to spiritual seekers, ordinary spiritual aspirants. And the homeland towards which he was moving is his true spiritual nature, Atman, the highest spiritual realization. That's the homeland towards which he was moving. The pilgrim corresponds to the spiritual seeker, the spiritual aspirant. The robbers, who are the robbers? The robbers are so many enemies that we have to confront in our spiritual life. Enemies could be various types. Some of our own negative tendencies, instincts, habits, strong vasanas, vritti, samskaras, characteristics, which actually act as our enemies in our spiritual life. Not helping us, but rather doing harm to us. And then, this blindfold, our obsession, our extreme attachment towards worldly objects, so we won't be able to see what we really ought to see. Our eyes are blindfolded by extreme likes and extreme dislikes. So, raga, dvesha, etc. Abhinivesha. Yet, you know, our mental world functions in this way. On the one hand, there is the experience. Experience could be something related to our interaction with external objects, by interacting with people, or it could be experience in the form of happiness, unhappiness, etc., coming from within our own mind. So, on the one hand, there is this experience, it's called bhoga. And then our reaction to those experiences. These two aspects explain the way our mind functions, our mental world in general. Our reactions to experiences could be either in the form of extreme liking, obsessive attachment. You find very often our extremely irrational, obsessive liking or attachments to certain things, though we know at heart that we don't really know, it's totally irrational, and we want to come out of it, this trap, still we are not able to do that. This is what you call raga, technically. You often find the reason for the conflict between what we want to do and what our mind allows us to do. Whatever we want to do, our mind doesn't allow. The mind may create some invisible stumbling blocks, obstacles, and then we may find an excuse for not doing the right thing. Actually, it is the backward pulling negative influence of our own inherited or accumulated tendencies and impressions that actually prevent us from doing what we actually want to do. So this is a kind of extreme obsessive liking or attachment to certain things. It's like a spiritual bondage, slavery. It's opposite, is extreme liking to certain things. So remember, extreme liking and extreme dislike. The first one is, I mentioned, attachment, extreme liking. Extreme attachment, obsessive attachment. Though we know it is not good, we want to come out of it, still our mind will not permit us to come out of it. Then it's opposite, extreme dislike, aversion. So, extreme liking and extreme dislike. is equally irrational. Obsessive dislike, obsessive aversion, which we know to be totally opposed to reason and logic, still, and though we want to come out of it, still it's like a trap. It makes us hate or dislike certain things. Though we have the conviction, the understanding that it is totally opposed to reason. So, this trap can function either in the form of extreme liking, attachment, or extreme aversion or dislike. Both have this enslaving effect. They make slaves of our minds. Like a trap. The difference between a spiritual seeker and a person who is not a spiritual seeker is, a spiritual seeker may also be a victim of this extreme liking and extreme dislike, obsessive attachment and aversion. If a spiritual seeker may also be a victim, but he also will be aware of the need to come out of this trap. A person who is not a spiritual aspirant may not be aware of the need to come out of this trap. So Sri Ramakrishna gives the example, fishermen catching fish. Some fish get caught in the trap, in that net, and it is a very wonderful place to live in. And they be caught and eaten. There are some fish who make a lot of effort to come out of the net. And they jump out and they get back to their freedom. And some fish never get caught. Sri Ramakrishna gives a number of examples. So, a spiritual seeker is like a fish that's caught in the net, which makes an effort to come out of the net. So, a spiritual seeker, when you listen to lectures, when you read scriptures, when you deeply think and contemplate, we become aware of the need to come out of this trap. Now, coming back to the story of the pilgrim. So you have to remember, the pilgrim is moving towards his spiritual goal. He is ambushed, dragged out of the main road, dragged to the thick forest and tied to a tree, blindfolded. Now what should he do if he is a sensible person? He should make a lot of noise. So in the Shankaracharya's commentary, there is one full paragraph imitating how a pilgrim should make... keep shouting to draw the attention of other travelers who are taking the same road to the same hometown. So if he is a sensible person, he will make a lot of noise. Aham dukhi, I'm taken away from my main road, I'm left in this thick forest, I'm dragged to a tree, I'm blindfolded, like that. So the first step for a spiritual seeker to get out of this spiritual stupor, spiritual sleep, is to make an effort to open his eyes. Come in the analogy, we must first of all recognize the need to go beyond the empirical world of momentary pleasures, temptations and desires. And this is possible by reading books, listening to ideas and deep contemplation. And then we feel a strong need to look beyond the world of today's momentary pleasures, enjoyments. So, an expression of an inner discontentment is the first step towards spiritual life, spiritual progress. So when he makes a lot of noise, we know what happens. There are other travelers who are taking the same road towards the same town. They may hear a lot of noise coming from a thick forest, and they may come looking for somebody, and they may come approach this person. The robbers had already left. Robbers won't stay there because they'll be afraid of policemen. That's the story also goes like. So the robbers have left. Another traveler who is taking the same road hears the cries of the pilgrim, and they come to the place where he is tied, and they remove his blindfold, That means they tell him, well, there are wonderful ideas in the Upanishads, in Vedanta scriptures, and the teachings of the great mystics. You should read them. That's the removing the blindfold. And then, you know, they may bring him back to the main road so that he can continue his journey forward. So this is, and we will continue the discussion tomorrow. It's a very famous analogy in the Chandogya Upanishad. Is that the whole psychology of spiritual stupor and spiritual awakening is clearly expounded in this illustrations. We will continue the discussion tomorrow. Now we have interaction. Thank you.
Samji, I have a question, but I cannot ask this question in front of everybody. So, and then can you give me tomorrow a little time to ask that question?
That we can, after the class, we'll discuss that.
Okay.
No, we can, yeah, like this, yeah. We can discuss that. So, any.
Maharaj, in the Shastras, do they talk about this mirage example also?
Yeah. Mirage is...
The real mirage.
Yeah. What you mistake it for is mirage, but there is something already there. So, mirage is not total non-existence. Because without the support, without a wide expanse of sand, or maybe a well-paved road, you don't mistake it for a lake or a water. So, something should be there to be mistaken to be something else. So, that's the idea.
For example, in the night, moonlight you don't see.
Yeah.
Even you may be traveling in the desert.
You don't see.
In the moonlight, but
yeah.
You don't see the mirage.
Yeah.
Only in sunlight.
Yeah. It creates that right geographical, you know, atmosphere. The brilliance, the smoothness which resembles water surface. Okay. So, any question? Anybody?
Nobody else? Swamiji, so in Samadhi is like, bliss.
Yeah.
Plus awareness.
Awareness, yeah.
With awareness,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And deep sleep is bliss without the awareness.
Yeah, awareness. But
without the awareness.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
But in Samadhi, to achieve Samadhi, people have to do a lot of spiritual practice this thing, right?
Yeah.
To get that bliss with awareness. But for deep sleep, people get it without that much of spiritual practicing. So is this the level of bliss same, or it has a distinction?
Yeah. No, there's a clear distinction. In deep sleep, our ability to become aware of what we are experiencing is completely lost, because we need an instrument to experience what we want to experience. For that we need mind. This mind is completely absorbed in Mula Vidya. It's called the causal ignorance. Because using in less technical language, in deep sleep, your ability to experience that bliss, that tranquility, is benumbed.
Benumbed by what?
You lose the faculty, your mind becomes non-functional. It gets merged in ignorance. See, actually, deep sleep is a state of total ignorance. There, you do not pursue duality, not because you transcend it, but because your ability to pursue duality is gone. That kind of state could be brought up by alcohols, by drugs. There is no spiritual content in it.
Yes.
You know, the Upanishad scholars, sages, they were trying to draw a comparison of the highest spiritual experience of Samadhi to something that every human being mechanically experiences. And I discussed veterinary doctors. They say animals have only deep sleep. They don't dream. So the animals also have deep sleep. They don't become sages. So animals also have God. As they come out of it. They don't have dreams. So the whole point is, it is just a comparison. I mean, but there is one aspect. Our natural quest for rest is always rest in the form of deep sleep. Nobody wants to dream. Even dream doesn't make you completely rested. Dreams can make you exhausted even. Dreams, wrong dreams, nightmares can make you terribly exhausted, disturbed. Nervous system, you find my agitation, all these you can see in a person who had just come out of dream state. I mean negative kinds of dream. So every dream is a state of interaction with objects at this subtle mental level. So in a way it is not very different from waking state. Actually we feel, people feel real restfulness only when they are within their own solitary world. If there is anybody or anything, you feel rested. So you want to take rest. You won't be thinking about, do you come later, I'm not tired, I should sit quiet. Why you should do that? Physically, you are actually sitting in an easy chair. But if you think and discuss and contemplate on something very seriously, you are not actually resting. So even as a mental projection, it could be a totally unsettling effect if you have got anything else other than you. Even an idea can become a disturbing factor. So what is the state of complete restfulness? A natural, effortless, spontaneous restfulness is a state in which you are one with yourself. That state is achieved in deep sleep. True. But when that state is experienced with full awareness, it leads to enlightenment. Otherwise, a natural human instinct. But then, the human quest for complete restfulness in the form of deep sleep and the higher quest for spiritual liberation, a state of absolute restfulness, absolute spiritual freedom, have got something in common. That's all. Just like when there is an excess of light, you don't see anything. It's totally dark, then also you don't see anything. So non-seeing of any object is common in both levels. But we're two different levels, right? But Vedanta psychology tells you that all people are looking for, they want restfulness in the form of deep sleep. They don't want any company. If there is any company, either your best friend or a thought will have a disturbing effect. A pleasant thought also will have a disturbing effect. So what is the state of absolute restfulness? A state in which there is no thought even, not to speak of any other companion. Even you are within your own solitary real self. That is a state of restfulness which you experience in deep sleep. That's why when people complain, I don't get sleep, it's a very big problem. Because the complete restfulness is possible only in deep sleep. But the same restfulness with awareness, you get in samadhi. Higher meditation also will have a soothing, resting effect. Because we transcend the duality. Transcend thoughts, vibrations of ideas and so on.
Swami Vivekananda said in one of his talks on yoga that in deep sleep we enter as fools and come out as fools.
Yeah.
Samadhi, we enter as fools, come out as sages.
Yeah.
That's the in the principle
degree. Yeah, no one can enter samadhi unless you are equipped, fully equipped. So otherwise samadhi doesn't occur. So that in fact Upanishad says Vyagrava Simhova, you know, animals, tigers, lions, all these wild animals also get some deep sleep and they come as tigers and lions using sage. That Upanishad has got very, very illustrative statements. Vyagrava, Misova, all wild animals also go experience samadhi. Sorry, experience susupti. Experience deep sleep, susupti, and they return as wild animals. Susupti doesn't have any transformative effect. That's the idea.
Swami, I want to ask you, it seems that we identify immediately with our name and form, the roles we play, as how we immediately react and see ourselves in the world. What is the best and most effective way to catch ourselves in the moment and remember that under that play is our true nature, so that we can begin to re-see ourselves as we go about our day?
We must remind ourselves of this by reading, thinking, and contemplating. Contemplation helps us to take these ideas to deeper levels of our consciousness. Contemplation. Reading with great concentration is effective, but more effective is deep-rooted, focused contemplation on that idea, because that will take the idea to deeper levels of our consciousness. So that will help us to suddenly refer to our true identity. That's that. That's
so
right.
As you go about your daily business and you're interacting with people, each other name and form, while you're doing that, you're also supporting that with
who you
truly.
When the pressure or when the identification with these external things comes to a very serious point, then we can easily refer to our true nature. Not that it should make us complacent or ineffective or indifferent. See, the Sri Ramakrishna puts, put jnanam. Jnanam means this highest knowledge in the pocket, somewhere, and live in this world. That's what he says. So, in the midst of all these activities, we tend to reach a threshold. Boundary line, beyond which, when we identify ourselves with these things, it will have a very damaging effect in the mental system. Extreme anxiety, extreme obsessive attachment, losing sleep, and even the nervous system, our thought ideas all get extremely intensified, obsessed with one thing. So at that point, we can stop and pause little. Oh, these things belong to this relative, changeable, empirical things. You can't expect perfection in this imperfect world. So that's how, when it reaches a point of extreme boundary, very often that there's a boundary line, actually. It happens for normal human beings also, very, very efficient, professional people. It happens. At that time, we can pause for a moment. Oh, but why do I expect perfection in this imperfect world? Why do I expect permanence in these impermanent things? So that simple question. It is a very, every student of physics understands that this world is changeable and varied in his experiences in different dimensions. But when we get focused onto one of these little minute things of this world, for the moment we forget that it is obviously inherently imperfect. At that time we have to remind ourselves of the fact that it is imperfect. So that's the real purpose of reading scriptures and all that, and discussion.
So while you're seeing yourself in your more true nature, you also look at all other things around you in the same way.
Yeah, we'll be able to put them in their proper places. Often we put them in improper places. In our priority, we very often put insignificant, silly things in the paramount position and worry, get concerned, too much things. That creates problem. So we should not give them a place higher than what they deserve. And that's what exactly the way Vedanta helps us in our everyday life. A faith in God also can help, but then the point is that God should be interpreted as a compassionate God of the whole humanity, not God of tribes, of groups, of believers, or antagonistic or hostile to non-believers. The God for the whole humanity. A God who is compassionate not only to those who believe in Him, but also towards those who reject Him, because they also belong to Him. So that kind of higher idea of God is not easily available in the normal traditional organized religions. That's where the need for a transcendental idea of supreme reality arises. If we can elevate God to that position, then see, I'm doing everything for God and the whole humanity without any boundary line, then it's possible. But the Vedanta, we can just Vedanta is nothing but spiritual common sense. Vedanta is very spiritualized dimension of common sense, actually. Common sense, you don't require any extraordinary intelligence. It is true, and we know intellectually that these things come and go, they are not permanent. But for a moment, we forget their impermanent nature, and we attribute permanence to the impermanent things. So that should be reversed. Vivekananda calls it dehypnotization, he called. We are hypnotized into thinking or looking upon the impermanent as the permanent. So we should get dehypnotized back into thinking the permanent only as the permanent and looking upon the impermanent as the impermanent. That's the idea. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
Maharaj,
yeah.
You said in samadhi, complete silence. But you said several steps down is the Omkara,
yeah.
Then mantras.
Yeah.
Can you explain a little bit?
That is, Sri Ramakrishna, I can explain this statement. No, Sri Ramakrishna, the gospel. So he says, you know, in samadhi, the highest samadhi, there is not even Omkara. So the whole Vedic, Vedantic, canonical structure is like this. At the lowest level, I don't say lowest, the primary level, say lowest is a cruel word. Primary level, we have mythological books, number of scriptures, which contain a lot of spiritual ideas, which also may be explained in illustrations, which may not have direct implication. Above that, we have the Vedas, and within the Vedas, there are the Upanishads, which are the essence of the Vedic literature. And all these Upanishads, wisdom, is contained in the Gayatri Mantra. Gayatri is the name of the meter, and also it is also the name of the highest spiritual mantra. It's a prayer for prayer to God for spiritual effulgence, realization, prayer to the all-pervading reality for blessing. That's the thing. That is Gayatri. It is somewhat, you know, it runs in two lines. And now, all this Gayatri, this whole Gayatri mantra is condensed in Om, Pranava. That particular mantra, Om. There is nothing beyond Om at the verbal level. And beyond Om is experience. And experience cannot be equated or described by any word symbol, even by a very abstract word symbol like Om. You cannot explain experience. So that's what Sri Ramakrishna says in the language of an analogy. At the highest samadhi experience level, we don't say anything. Everything is beyond word, beyond thought, beyond contemplation. You cannot even contemplate on anything, because for contemplation also we need something on which we contemplate, and we contemplate. There should be subject-object differentiation. In the highest experience, the subject-object differentiation also vanishes. Only one reality. At that time, we don't think anything. We just experience. This highest experience, which we call samadhi, can be found in the life of great devotional philosophers also. Wherever a great devotee of God or a great spiritual seeker experiences unity and total identity with God, with the God idea, that is a state of some kind of a samadhi. technically samadhi in yoga and Vedanta certain well structured definitions. I'm putting in a simple ordinary.
So Swami Vivekananda says that is avang manasa gochara.
Yeah, avang manasa gochara is a Sanskrit word. It means beyond mind, beyond words. Literally it means what mind and words cannot see. That's the meaning of avang manasa gochara, a Sanskrit word. It's a mantra. What words and mind cannot see or comprehend beyond contemplation, beyond description, beyond definition. All experiences are really beyond description. But at the highest spiritual level, when you are one with the reality, you don't experience anything other than yourself. You are one with the experience. We are actually trying to explain what is beyond explanation. So discussion itself is not necessary.
In the Gospel, Thakur talks about the salt doll.
Yeah.
Trying to report the depth of the ocean.
Yeah. But about the samadhi, they say shavikalpa samadhi and nirvikalpa samadhi. Yeah. Yes, shavikalpa samadhi is the first stage where you have a focus, you contemplate on, you focus, you one with that. And nirvikalpa samadhi with the focus also disappears, you become one with it. The samadhi that Sri Ramakrishna is referring to is nirvikalpa samadhi, which is beyond words, beyond description, beyond comprehension, which is experience itself, which is beyond approach of scriptures or words or anything.
So, is there the degree that shavikalpa samadhi is lower than nirvikalpa samadhi?
First stage. Shavikalpa goes away, nirvikalpa.
Both are samadhi.
So, of course, you have to remember, you know, I'm giving Yoga Sutra class over the last 2 years. So, when we discuss Samadhi in yoga philosophy, we should remember it is different from what it means in Vedanta. Vedanta expounds the highest and the central philosophy of spiritual life. Yoga is true. Yoga is only a means for reaching the highest degree of fitness to understand Vedanta. So yoga helps us, but it doesn't directly take us to the highest experience level. That's the view of Vedanta. So we will continue discussion tomorrow. Okay.
Yes.
Thank you. Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Tat Sat Sri Ramakrishna Pranamastu.